Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. President Clinton has called a meeting. The Forest Conference in Portland, Oregon, will bring together ecologists and economists to find a way to save the ancient forests and the timber companies. But finding a workable formula is made all the more difficult by the widely divergent opinions as to the cause of the region's crisis. Also this time, your comfortable washed-out jeans make great writing paper. And Jeffrey Heal speculates on the high cost of worldwide environmental cleanup.
You're probably talking about a cost of 2 to 3% of worldwide national income.
These stories this time on The Environment Show, a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York, and this is Bruce Robertson. With his proverbial laser beam, President Clinton will focus attention on the Pacific Northwest for one day in April. In a White House press release, the president said he would call to order a forest conference in Portland, Oregon. Mr. Clinton said, quote, "Planning and good long-term management can help us protect jobs and the unique old-growth forests that are as much a part of our national heritage as the Grand Canyon or Yosemite," end quote. James Geisinger, president of the Northwest Forestry Association in Portland, representing the timber industry, is looking forward to the conference.
Well, we're very excited that the president has decided to take a personal interest in this issue. His appearance in the Pacific Northwest is very timely. It's time that we move to resolve this issue, and the quicker that can occur, the better off all interest groups are going to be.
Also in the White House announcement, Vice President Al Gore said, quote, "We don't have to sacrifice jobs to protect a unique natural heritage," end quote. However, the vice president went on to say, any agreement must be based on science. Geisinger agrees to a point when he says,
first thing that has to happen is the legal gridlock that has put a stranglehold on federal timber supply in this region simply has to be broken. Secondly, the agencies that are responsible for managing these resources have to be forced to work in a cooperative way towards a mutually acceptable goal. And I think that goal has to be developed and prescribed by this administration. And lastly, in the long term, I think we need to change our approach to managing federal resources to adopt an ecosystem-based management approach where a multitude of values are protected and provided for on all of our forest lands. And I think if we can do that, we can find that we can provide substantial amounts of timber volume to produce wood products that are consumed by everybody in America and still provide the environmental values that the public demands from our public forest lands.
Recently, the National Home Builders Association held a press conference in Washington to call attention to another growing crisis related to the timber industry in the Pacific Northwest. They said lumber prices and then new construction will skyrocket this year because of lumber shortages brought on by the logging ban in the ancient forests. However, Fran Hunt, a forestry expert with the National Wildlife Federation, says neither the courts nor federal policy are to blame here.
What really is affecting log shortages, and it's something that the timber industry doesn't want to talk about, it's something that the home builders don't seem to want to talk about, is the log export issue. In the last 10 years, we've exported from this country some 33 billion board feet of unprocessed logs to Japan and other countries. And for each billion board feet of these logs that we send overseas, we ship enough wood out of this country to build 85,000 new U.S. homes. And what's more, because we ship those logs unprocessed, we haven't even turned them into lumber, we actually end up causing the loss of 6,000 domestic mill jobs for each billion board feet of timber. The industry doesn't like to talk about this because they have profited mightily from log exports. But you can't talk about log shortages, you can't talk about lumber prices with any credibility unless you address squarely the drain on our timber supply represented by log exports.
Well, let's be very clear about this. It has been against the law to export federal timber for almost 25 years.
Again, Jim Geisinger.
Federal timber is not exported from the Pacific Northwest. Furthermore, there are very strict requirements in place that prevent private landowners from exporting their own timber and then turning around and buying federal timber to run through their mills. That's called substitution. That is also against the law. So what we have in the Northwest is two very distinct components of an industry. One comprised of private landowners that export some of their logs to foreign countries but are not involved in buying federal timber, and another component of the industry, and they're typically smaller, independently owned, family-owned mills that depend on federal timber, have always depended on federal timber, are not involved in the exportation of logs. And it's that component of the industry that is feeling the wrath of these lawsuits and litigation that has been promoted by the environmental community. And it's those mills and the communities that depend on them that we are trying to save in this debate.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Geiser, let me ask you, if there is only a small percentage of the ancient old-growth forest left on federal land, why do you, in the timber industry, why do you want it? What is a tree, why is a tree 900 years old more valuable for lumber than a younger growth tree on private land?
Well, there's no question that that the quality of wood that comes from the older trees is highly desirable. We can get clear-grained wood that it can only be used for certain types of products like window moldings and door moldings and things like that. So there's no question that the value of that timber is much higher than in the second growth forest.
Hunt of the National Wildlife Federation says the cry of limited timber leading to finished lumber shortages now is both unnecessary and misleading.
Each spring, lumber prices go up. Lumber dealers and home builders don't keep large inventories of lumber over the winter. They're not using it, and it doesn't make economic sense. So they always buy lumber in the spring, and the price always goes up somewhat in the spring. Each time we have an economic recovery, as we did in 1976 and as we did in the early 80s, demand for lumber goes up as housing starts go up, and the price goes up as the demand goes up. These are patterns that we have seen again and again. They are patterns that the timber industry would now like to blame on the spotted owl, but they're really patterns that have very little to do with environmental protection. If you look at the timber resources in question, you see that the amount of forest land, commercial forest land, in the national forest in the Pacific Northwest and on the other federal forest that is being currently protected for the ancient forest ecosystem, not just for the owl, is about is less than 0.5% of our nation's total timberland base. And if you look at it on a volume basis, we're talking about less than 5% of the lumber that is annually consumed in this country.
So, with rising prices, mills shut down, forests off limits, species endangered, international trade, and the domestic economy of the region all on the line here, what is to be expected from a one-day forest conference, which, incidentally, will be held just one day before the president meets with Russian President Boris Yeltsin in Vancouver, British Columbia? If this is the time for rhetoric to end and action to begin, what will happen? If the president came to you and said, "What are your suggestions, and be specific," what would you say? Fran Hunt.
Well, the first thing you have to remember is that only, I think it's important to keep in mind as I answer this question, is 95% of the Pacific Northwest economy doesn't deal with the timber industry. So I'm not going to answer this question as if the timber industry is the driving force there. It isn't. What you need to address are those local communities and those parts of the region where the timber is still a big part. But overall, the region has long since diversified beyond a dependence on the timber industry. But with that said, I think that we need to do some very specific things in local areas. We need to take ancient forest protection that is scientifically based. We need to put in place local job retraining, educational opportunities, economic diversification grants. We need to help communities do more of what many communities in the region are already doing, and that is, looking at their towns, looking at their people, trying to figure out what makes the best long-term sense for their populations, and go towards sustainable economies. Many small communities have been working in the last few months and years to move away from the timber industry, or to move away from a sole dependence on the timber industry, and to diversify and to have other job opportunities. So we're talking about everything from, you know, job retraining for individuals to economic development grants for communities.
Well, I guess that is specific, but probably not as specific as the talk will be around the conference table. And from the Forestry Association perspective, Geisinger is just as vaguely specific.
To move from where we are now to an ecosystem-based management approach, an approach to managing forest resources where all values are accommodated, and producing timber in an environmentally sensitive way that maintains and preserves other values, and essentially maintaining the long-term health of our forest ecosystems is the objective. And there's a variety of ways to do that, and I think he needs to give the latitude and the authority to the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management to move forward with some of those concepts.
James Geisinger, president of the Northwest Forestry Association in Portland, Oregon. Francis Hunt spoke to us from the Washington headquarters of the National Wildlife Federation. To the Forest Conference, the president intends to bring Vice President Al Gore, Carol Browner, head of the Environmental Protection Agency, Secretary Bruce Babbitt, Department of Interior, Labor Secretary Robert Reich, and Mike Espy, Secretary of the Department of Agriculture. While the conference is not likely to spell the end of the controversies, perhaps we will see the beginning of the end. This is Bruce Robertson.
Textile trimmings look a lot like what's left when you make cookies. They're the remnant left when the pattern for the T-shirt...
Timothy Crane runs his hands through a pile of cloth scraps, checking for colored threads and pieces of elastic. Crane is head of business development at Crane & Company, manufacturers of the paper on which our currency is printed. Check your wallet. Also the largest producer of rag-based paper in the country, Crane & Company is located in Dalton, Massachusetts. While the company has been making paper from cloth for years, Crane says there is an added advantage to using cotton scraps from the textile industry.
The principal difference is that Crane, in its traditional papers, Crane's office letterhead papers and social stationery papers, while the starting point is 100% cotton, there are materials in there that have alternative uses, either within the paper industry, among our competitors, for example, or other applications for converting into materials. With cotton textile cuttings, the raw material is salvaged from the waste stream. There is no alternative source. It's all headed for the dump.
The company has used many kinds of scraps, such as thermal underwear and muslin, in its paper. But it was an independent paper maker in New Mexico who introduced them to something new, paper made entirely from blue jeans. Judith Lancaster is Crane's marketing manager.
The idea was brought to Crane & Company in August of 1992 by a gentleman by the name of Stephen Watson, who owns a company called Watson Paper Company out of Albuquerque, New Mexico. And Mr. Watson's company is a handmade paper operation, and he had been looking for sources of raw materials to make papers, and there was a Levi plant in Albuquerque, and he went to see what they did with their rags and found out that they and a number of the other Levi plants were landfilling a great portion of the denim cutting.
Watson brought his idea to Crane & Company to develop on a commercial level. Crane and Levi Strauss struck a deal. For every pound of paper the Levi Company buys from Crane, Crane will take 1 pound of denim cuttings. Lancaster estimates the project will reuse about 1 million pounds of denim scraps in its first year. The end product is a stationary paper the color of faded blue jeans. The paper is being used in Levi Strauss offices, and paper made from black denim will be used to make shopping bags. Crane says Levi's waste problem is familiar in the textile industry. While the company produces millions of pounds of cloth scraps every year, landfill space is disappearing. Crane says Levi Strauss took an unusual approach to the problem.
I would say that they're unique in being proactive in looking for a solution to that problem. I suspect it confronted other organizations as mostly an operations problem. The cost of disposal is mounting. It's an unfortunate consequence of doing business. Levi looked at the problem as an opportunity. As soon as somebody presented to them the possibilities, they jumped right on top of it.
Much of the scrap from Levi's 12 denim cutting plants around the nation ends up here in a rotary boiler. The gigantic iron globe works like a huge washing machine. Rotating on an axis suspended from the ceiling, the boiler agitates a high-temperature wash of denim cuttings and sodium hydroxide, which strips off textile chemicals and some of the cloth's dye. After several hours of washing, the cuttings are the color of worn-out blue jeans. Crane says this process usually takes place at another plant. The denim scraps are then shipped to the paper company for the pulping process.
Pulp then is shipped to Crane in sort of a beater-ready condition, meaning the next thing we do to it is put it into our beaters, which further refine the fiber, develop the fiber such that it has the capability to bond and form a very strong and durable piece of paper. And that's more sort of batch-wise processing. They're very large stone or tile vessels with the pulp, the textile and water circulating inside being subjected to severe mechanical action from these a drum with bars radiating from it that grinds the pulp against a lava stone bed plate.
After the beating process, the pulp is spread on a moving mesh bed. Water drains out into a pool below as the pulp moves between two rollers, squeezing out remaining water. Finally, the sheets run through a series of rollers, producing the final product. The paper is made of 100% denim fibers, pulled from scraps at the Levi plants. But as Judith Lancaster explains, the denim paper does not qualify for the recycled paper symbol.
Under the recycled definitions, to put the recycled symbol on a product, there are certain percentages, and they are certain of post-consumer. And post-consumer is defined as it has to have been, the raw material has to have been bought as something else and used by you or I or somebody and then discarded. And when someone puts that on their paper, the symbol, it does contain it. What you don't know is what the other 80% or so of fiber that makes up that piece of paper is.
Lancaster says these regulations plague paper companies trying to meet the standard, so Crane and Company devised its own symbol, a cotton bowl outlined by arrows, similar to the common recycling symbol. Timothy Crane says the symbol stands for 100% recovered cotton textiles. He is not concerned about the lack of official recognition. When the denim paper enters the marketplace in May, he expects consumers will understand its environmental impact and approve, once again leaving the government to play catch-up. This is Bruce Robertson. When we ask what are the costs of environmental degradation, we usually mean what are the costs to human health, to the survival of plants and animals, to the dwindling stockpiles of natural resources. However, as these costs do mount, ecologists are being joined by politicians and economists who ask more literally, what are the costs? In other words, how much money will we have to spend to restore human health, to protect plants and animals, to conserve natural resources. Questions that emerged from, or perhaps actually stalled, the United Nations Earth Summit last June. Economist Dr. Jeffrey Heal, Vice Dean of the Columbia University School of Business, a scholar with a most impressive resume of teaching and writing, Dr. Heal says the most pressing problems are those that affect the entire planet. And before we set about to spend international dollars, first we must separate what is global from what is local.
Okay, there's a set of risks associated with environmental abuse which occur at a truly global and a truly international level. You mentioned the Earth Summit in Rio. There they talked a lot about climate change, and that's obviously a completely global phenomenon. And they talked about depletion of the ozone layer, and that's a very global phenomenon again. Other events which have this kind of really international dimension are acid rain. You know, acid rain goes across countries, goes across continents even. And to take a more sensational and acute problem, you've got something like a nuclear meltdown at Chernobyl. I mean, that affected several hundred thousand people in, I think, either six or seven countries. And if you had a really big nuclear disaster, that could be thought of as a really global event, ultimately. And I'm trying to distinguish between events of that sort, which occur at a truly global level, have a global impact, and are therefore the subject of global regulation, global negotiation, distinguish those from localized environmental effects, say, you know, atmospheric smog over Los Angeles, release of PCBs into the groundwater in New Jersey. You know, things which can affect a lot of people, but you can contain them within a few hundred square miles.
Complicating the search for an answer is another problem. Often, we don't know what the problem is. For example,
we really don't know what is the likelihood of serious negative climate change. We know that it's a possibility. We know that it's somewhere on the scale, that in principle it could happen, but whether it's likely to happen, unlikely to happen, extremely improbable, we just don't know.
Further complicating the search for a global consensus is what has been identified as the North-South split. Industrialized nations have capital to pursue cleaner technologies. The developing and therefore less wealthy nations have little capital and are acquiring basic technologies. China and India, for example, just want to burn coal, anyhow, anyway. Never mind burning it cleanly for now. Heal says this might require a smoother, easier transfer or sharing of Western technologies. And he says the vehicle for doing this likely will be private industry, with the marketplace guiding and controlling where and how it is done. But the question remains, environmental risk at what cost? How much do we need to spend? The answer, coming from an economist such as Dr. Heal, is to be anticipated with a wince. But is there a way to make it happen?
It's big. There's no question about that. But it's no bigger than we spend on many other things which are probably less worthwhile. I mean, big meaning that if we enacted globally environmental preservation programs which would meet, you know, 60 to 70% of the more ambitious environmental targets, you're probably talking about a cost of 2 to 3% of worldwide national income. Which would mean, you know, for everybody in the world, it would mean that they would lose 2 to 3% of their income. Now, that's a big number, of course. It's a very big number. But on the other hand, most countries probably spend 6 to 10% of their income on defense. The U.S. spends 13% of its national product on health care. If you could trim that from 13% to 10%, then the 3% that you could release would probably meet a very, very broad range of environmental targets.
Dr. Jeffrey Heal, professor of economics and vice dean of the Columbia University Business School. He suggests that within the next 15 to 20 years, most of the industrialized nations will be contributing the requisite 2 to 3%. Dr. Heal spoke to us on the campus of Bard College, Annandale-on-Hudson. And this is Bruce Robertson. And that's our report on The Environment Show this week. The Environment Show, a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. Our thanks this week to Karen Kelly for the story on Levi's to Paper. For a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show, program number 168. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer, and this is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont.